Not reinventing the wheel is always a good idea. So if you are able to enforce what is already in place, generally is a very good starting point.
Hello and welcome to the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. I'm one of the hosts, Megan Rutkai, joined by Franz Ocelia and Zach Wheeler, and our special guest, Dr. Dore. Today, we will be discussing the ongoing trade war between the world's two largest economies, the United States and China. The trade war began on September 2018, when U.S. President Trump announced tariffs on $200 billion worth of Chinese goods, citing alleged Chinese unfair trade practices. The Chinese government retaliated with tariffs of its own. Despite ongoing trade negotiations, the U.S.-China trade relationship remains fraught.
By some measures, these tariffs constitute the largest trade war in history. But many economists, business leaders, and international organizations alike say that this trade war only hurts economic growth in both countries. So why is this trade war happening? And what is the role of the World Trade Organization?
To answer this question, we are pleased to welcome Dr. Giovanna Maria Dora Dore. Dr. Dore is a political economist within almost 20 years of experience at the World Bank in the East Asia and the Pacific region. Her focuses include growth and development in emerging markets and transitioning economies. And she was part of the negotiations for China's accession to the World Trade Organization in 2001. Dr. Dore, thank you so much for joining us. We're very happy to have you.
Thank you for having me.
First, we would like to ask, what is a trade war and how often do they occur between major countries?
Okay. So a trade war has a variety of definitions. And if anyone listening will go on the U.S. Trade Representative page, they actually include a number of interpretation of the trade war. Technically speaking, a trade war is an economic confrontation that results from one or more countries that apply protectionist measures. And normally the protectionist measures are either tariffs or sort of like levies or other type of non-barrier sort of like economic tools that countries may use to benefit more from the trade dynamic. Generally, what happens is an escalation of how these measures are managed between the countries that are involved in a trade war. And it really depends the length on whether or not the countries involved in a trade war would like to use the WTO as an international framework where to solve the dispute, or whether they prefer to actually go unilaterally outside the World Trade Organization, which is generally a faster way to solve the dispute, but not necessarily the most effective and the one that tends to establish a negative precedent.
So, Dr. Dore, can you maybe talk to us a little about what are the main points of tension between the U.S. and China? What started this trade war? Are there other factors unrelated to trade that contributed to it, or is it really just trade policy?
The current dispute is framed as a trade dispute, and it's indeed involved many elements of trade. However, interestingly enough, if you look at the trade statistics, the deficit in trade with China has been growing every year since 1985. So obviously it's not something new or something that probably the U.S. administration has never thought about or never been confronted with. In this particular case, looking at many of the statements made by members of the U.S. administration, specifically the Secretary of State, Pompeo, but also the former Secretary of Defense, Mattis, there are other elements. Specifically, James Mattis pointed out at the made references in terms of freedom of navigation in the South China Sea, which is a huge point of contention between the U.S. and China, but for that matter, also the U.S. and other Southeast Asian and Northeast Asian countries. And Secretary Pompeo has made very clear and specific references to the Belt and Road Initiative that China has been pursuing for a few years now, specifically saying if it's too good to be true, probably it is, sort of like. So there is definitely a political element, but given the more transactional and economic interest of the current administration and the fact that the point of contention between China and the United States on trade and exchange rate manipulation and other economic issues have been growing quite significantly. Definitely it's economic, but there are political aspects as well. And let's not forget that is also a battle between two very large political powers, one of which is perceived as growing without sort of like control, which would be China. And so obviously, I don't think it would be correct to see the current trade dispute as just one
particular,
particular aspect.
Right. And some experts have suggested that these problems that the United States and China have been having go back to when China joined the World Trade Organization in 2001. So what were the terms of China's accession to the WTO, and also how did this change the economic relationship between the US and China?
One clarification that I think is opportune is that China did not have specific terms in its accession to the WTO. If you go on the, once again, the U.S. Trade Representative page, the document we have here, it chronicles very, very, in a very detailed way, all the steps that have been taken. China went through exactly the same process that every country does, which normally involves three main steps. The first one is that you request sort of like to join the organization, and then there is a thorough review of all your trade practices, what changes in the policies will need to be made to meet the standard of the organization, but also the standard of the world trade that is at the moment in place. The second step is that a specific country that for the relevance in the economic, in the world economy, and also the relevance of the relationship that they may have with China, can have bilateral discussion to clarify particular sort of like hotspots of sort of like the negotiation. This is this happens at the same time in which China discusses with every other country within the WTO. And at the end of these discussions, sort of like the results are submitted and end up being in a protocol that details each single step that China has to take between the moment of that it joins the organization to when actually particular landmark changes need to be made. These are very long negotiation. In the case of China, it took about 15 years. And something that is done is that over those years, the progress that the country that is asking to join the WTO makes are monitored so that things can be changed. This is exactly what happened for China. If you guys go and see what happened in the case of Indonesia and other Asian countries, it's exactly the same. What is interesting in looking at the specific is that points that were flagged as meaningful for attention were lack of strong governance or transparency, which once again is something that now it's becoming a very sticky point. There were already mentions of intellectual property rights, but more in terms of copyrights or sort of like technology content, not at the level that we are seeing right now. And then sort of like a much more specific technical things. So it wasn't necessarily different from what another country will get. However, sort of like there were probably more bilateral discussion within the agreement because of the relevance of the Chinese market. At the time, the United States was having exactly the same misgivings that is having right now in terms of judging the potential of the Chinese economy, the fact that there was no trust in how some of the reforms will be set in place or how well the reforms will be developed. We're exactly at the same point right now. I was mentioning to Megan earlier a document that is in the that is on the Brookings website. The document is from 20 years ago, and it was more or less written at the time in which China joined the WTO. If you take away the date and you read portions of this document, you will think has been written right now, right, and addresses exactly the same issues. So nothing was unexpected. I think that the fact that you have two very large, powerful countries that are becoming, one is trying to regain respect and relevance, and the other one has it by sheer size, creates much more of an issue for sort of like the WTO that other countries would.
Right.
And I think we already touched on this, but would you please specify on what aspects of China's ascension do you think have contributed to the current dispute, including the lack of transparency in government and intellectual property rights and others?
I think that one issue is that the willingness of countries that were already part of the WTO to access the Chinese market has blinded to a certain extent, even if temporarily, the relevance of concerns like we have mentioned in terms of the difficulty of addressing those issues. Finding agreement on intellectual property right is not an easy thing. So thinking that with time we will solve this, it was probably a little bit sort of like optimistic. Mm-hmm. But for instance, in terms of one factor that is constantly mentioned these days, which is the forced technology transfer that very often the Chinese government requires for technology company that are not Chinese to enter the Chinese market. This was already debated, included, and agreed in the original document for China accession to the WTO. That means that even for US companies, the United States government knew that this could have become an issue. So probably the very large size of the Chinese market played very much a role in that. Something else that wasn't at the time as much of an issue as it is right now is the cyber theft, which became way too broad at the moment, sort of like to be managed in a non-controversial and non-hostile way. And also the fact that in many cases, the volume of counterfeit goods, whether it is drugs or sort of like clothing or
sneakers,
textiles, sneakers,
sports jerseys, <Right. laughs>
anything has reached, I think is we are sort of like around $600 billion at the moment, which is really a significant issue for many companies that want to operate sort of like in a non sort of like in a sort of like a, in a formal way and trying to actually not violate laws. So I think that there are these aspects that couldn't be foreseen entirely or that have grown more than what it was expected.
So going back to 2001, do you think that after 15 years of negotiation, there were outside pressure to just finally let China in, even though there were some asterisks that could potentially cause problems? Or
no, I don't. I honestly, that's an average number. It's the average time that it takes. I definitely there were pressures for China to join the WTO, but it wasn't at the expenses of issues that could have become problematic. The main issue at the time was that the fall of the Berlin Wall sort of like brought a lot of Eastern European countries gravitating towards the European Union. And so the fact that China was becoming a very interesting market for the European Union as well helped pushing sort of like the relevance of China. And it was also relatively a few years after the Tiananmen Square incident, in which China was trying to rehabilitate itself globally. And so making positive strides to meet the demands of the World Trade Organization and join the WTO was definitely a point in that direction.
And do you think that some of the liberalization that China undertook and some of the reforms that it took in order to sort of meet those milestones in preparation for joining the WTO, do you think that China was moving that direction anyways, or that the WTO really provided the impetus for those changes within China?
Oh, I don't know. You would need a crystal ball to know that. Well, fortunately, we don't have the counterfactual, right? We only have what we have right now. One important point to be made is that for the liberalization that happened in the financial sector and in the banking sector, probably China wasn't as ready as and continued to be. The ability to absorb FDI, or the ability sort of like to provide the transparency, accountability, and it's not necessarily there at the level that the United States, but also the European Union would like to see, but has not been enough of an obstacle to stop the negotiation or to sort of like the progression of that. There is always this incredible optimism, like that things will be done, or that at some point there will be a convergence among all the needs of the different parties at the table. Sometimes it happens, hasn't happened here, but also it was relatively easy to foresee in that way. My sense is that even before China decided to apply for WTO membership, China was already converging to their own version of the market economy. And so probably we would have seen many, many similar changes and reforms in the same way. It would be, I think, a little bit naive to think that China would have not joined the WTO anyway, because it is the second largest economy in the world, and you cannot leave such a large market and such a large sort of like a production part of the economy outside the global supply chain that it's anyway part of the WTO. But no, I don't know, because I don't have the crystal ball. So mine is just speculation.
Well, thank you.
Dr. Doria, I'm interested about something, because I didn't take your intercession class. So nice catch, Megan. A lamp almost fell. That was good.
Because Franz bumped into
it. We're back. I know that President Trump famously tweeted about the trade imbalance between the United States and China. I think he tweeted something along the lines of, like, we're losing $500 billion a year, something like that.
And the day after was double that amount.
Yes. So what does he mean by that? Is that a valid claim? Is that a problem, the trade imbalance between the United States and China? Just if you could expand on that a bit would be great.
Well, leaving the exact number aside, because when President Trump mentions numbers, it's never quite clear if it's correct or if it's going to be sort of an exponential increase of it. The U.S.-China trade imbalance has been there and has been growing since 1985, as we have said. So it's hardly a new thing.
Right.
The U.S. Chamber of Commerce believes that looking at trade deficit is a very crude and not necessarily effective way of understanding the relationship and the trade or business relationship between two countries. They specifically made this statement for China-US relations. And I tend to agree. Sort of like obviously no country wants to be sort of like on the losing side of trade. But also, I think it's really relevant to see what the trade relationship brings. In the case of China, I think that a point of contention is not only trade, is the exchange rate manipulation and the fact that China has always gotten away with sort of like bypassing some of the previous commitment or the way in which the rule should be applied. But at the same time, if you look at the transactional approach that the current administration takes, if we wanted to see who are the winners and the losers at the moment, well, China hasn't given up anything, right? China has received a 10% tariffs at the moment that if an agreement is not found with the ongoing discussion, is going to escalate to the 25%. That's a threat. The Chinese economy can diffuse sort of like the 10% tariffs. There are particular sectors that are being impacted more, but they can manage that. At the same time, they have brought the U.S. to the table to open up discussions for other things. At the moment, the United States is the one who has more to lose because, to his credit, has convinced China to have discussion about trade, which is not an easy thing to do. But sort of China has retaliated in kind to the 10% tariffs and has targeting particular products that are produced in Republican districts.
Like
so
soybeans in Ohio.
Exactly. Right? Or, and, or sort of like coal and other, sort of like I think it's...
aluminum.
Something else. But what is interesting is that they're given sort of like a different... interpretation of the tariffs because they are showing that they can be not necessarily threatening but painful in the same way. The other thing that is interesting is that the United States is pushing also for more of a policy agenda, which requires a transformation in the structural sort of like in a framework that China uses for trade. Okay. Those are key, but it takes time. So I'm not quite sure that is going to be an immediate result.
Right.
So.
Interesting. Thank
right.
You,
so what then do you think would be the best way to resolve the current economic tension and, I guess, to a certain degree, political tension between the U.S. and China? Or is there even a way to fix it? Or is this just two superpowers that are ready to rival each other for a prolonged period of time?
I don't think that there is anything that needs to be fixed. I think that sort of like this is run-of-the-mill international relations with two very large, powerful countries. I think that, once again, if we look at the past, this is not new. The United States has done exactly the same with Japan between the 1980s and the 1990s. It was different items. In that case was, once again, a trade deficit. The surplus was, I think, the automotive parts or cars. It took 10 years, and then Japan had other economic problems that intervened. But at some point, an agreement was found. In the case of China, I think that it will be key to see what the current discussion bring. Right now, nobody knows. As of yesterday, the Secretary of the Treasury said that finally offices of to enforce the future agreement have been sort of like agreed upon, and this was a point of contention. And so probably we will see something more coming up. I don't necessarily think that the U.S. will get as much as is expecting, mostly because they will want to see the trade deficit reverse, which is not going to happen. But also, I think that probably is bringing to the table a discussion in terms of intellectual property rights, the fact that the technology content transfer should not be forced, that needs to be brought to the table. And at the same time, the United States need this discussion at the moment to push for the USMCA to be approved, because the U.S. Trade Representative clearly stated that without that, there is no U.S. trade policy that has a global reach. And so to show that you have relevance in making negotiation with your main rival makes clear the need for having a framework for trade like the USMCA, which hasn't been ratified yet. So these are all aspects that you need to put in the context to see where the discussions with China will go. I don't think it's going to be the end of it. It's probably going to be, let's see, the next episode, mm-hmm. but it might actually relieve the tension. So I think that everybody loses when you have a trade war, even if it's not an immediate loss. But what you lose in terms of relationship, it's going to be hard to reconstruct, even if you have a transactional approach as the current president.
And you mentioned USMCAs and the importance of ratifying those, mm-hmm. and especially, you know, needing a relationship to do so. Can you elaborate a little bit on what the ratification of a USMCA would mean for this relationship?
This is about a few years ago, the United States government commissioned a report that looked at the specific of the countries with which the U.S. had the largest trade deficit. And this report, who hasn't been released to the public, includes 16 countries. Of course, there is China, there is sort of like Korea, there is Vietnam, there is the EU, which is not one country, but sort of like a collection of them. The relevance of the report is that they looked at how existing trade agreements could help manage some of these trade imbalances. So the fact that you are in the midst of sort of like a ratification of your largest trade agreement, who includes some key provisions that are supposed to be reflective of the new take on trade of the current administration, it's really relevant for, I would say, an illustration of what could come next. If the USMCA is not ratified, it's very likely that this report with the 16 countries specific is going to come to light again. And probably there will be there will be a push for either more bilateral free trade agreement that after a specific number lose their economies of scale value, but also it would be much more complex for the United States to put itself in front of not just one-on-one country, but countries that may have other trade arrangement. Let's not forget that since the United States left the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the remaining countries are pretty much moving forward. So that is something else to consider in terms of trade blocks or trade dynamics to come.
Thank you. And we've, I guess, discussed sort of the trade war and how that might not bring the results that the U.S. is looking for. And we've discussed potential new trade policies, which may be more effective if ratified or accepted. But would the enforcement of the existing trade policy, would that be an easier way or a more succinct way of achieving the U.S.'s goals, in your opinion?
Not reinventing the wheel is always a good idea. So if you are able to enforce what is already in place, generally is a very good starting point. I don't see any of these a relationship as cast in stone. So even if you have a trade agreement, things can be changed or modified to reflect the new realities that the trade system brings in. So I don't see anything monolithic or there forever.
Professor, I think I might already know the answer to this, but but a lot of the Franz and I take a political science course called American Grand Strategy, where we have two SAIS professors who kind of focus on American foreign policy and grand strategy, and we've had a couple foreign policy professionals come in and speak to the class, and we have asked them about what they think of the Trump administration's foreign policy, and the general consensus, it seems like, is that it's pretty poor because of a couple of reasons. If you want to know why, listen to the last podcast. but the one thing that is interesting to me is that most of them seem to agree that they think the Trump administration is correct in dealing or addressing or trying to bring China to the negotiating table because of its unfair trade practices. And they think that the way that the Trump administration has gone about doing this through the trade war, through tariffs, has actually been effective. It sounds like you disagree with that. Is that correct?
I don't disagree with the portion of the answer that bringing China to the table is the thing to do. Right. Definitely, yes. I don't necessarily agree with the fact that the United States has chosen the unilateral approach rather than to address these particular issues within the framework of the WTO. The reason why I disagree is not because one is faster than the other one, it takes forever and probably would be a solution that doesn't please the majority of the people, but it establishes a very dangerous precedent because you are made a conscious decision to act outside the international framework to which you have subscribed and you are a member of. If everybody starts following the same logic, not so much the WTO becomes irrelevant because in the minds and eyes of many countries already is, they don't see the point of it. Right. But is that there is a need for a larger framework of regulations and institutions than one single country. Mm. And so that is where I disagree. I don't disagree on the fact that countries need to be kept accountable to what they agree on. I also think that in the case of the United States and China, the United States probably is asserting itself economically, also because politically is finding difficult to do at so many different levels. Right. So,
right. And then turning to, you know, this multilateral spirit that should have happened, because I've also heard from Foreign Policy, Foreign Affairs, saying like, oh, the United States should have convinced the Europeans to like help contain China economically. But at the same time, we haven't, I mean, this could be wrong, but the Europeans haven't really expressed a concern with China's economic practices to the degree that they, that the Americans have. That's correct?
No, they actually, they have. Yeah. They have. It was 2 days ago in on the Financial Times, there was an article from that was citing the sort of like European trade representative that blasted at China and said, we have enough of what you guys are, have been doing. I think that once again, in the United States, I'm not so sure that there is constant and enough attention to what the European Union does, unless it's a direct of direct relevance for the United States. Mm-hmm. And very recently, since President Trump had been elected, the relationship between the European Union and the United States has become a little bit more tense. So probably not necessarily interested in recognizing that for some instances that the European Union has the same concerns that sort of like the United States has. The European Union per se has a different issue to deal with, where there is a common trade policy that the European Union use vis-a-vis different countries. For many trade aspects, single European member country can still make their own decision. Case in point, Italy decided to sign an MOU for the Belt and Road Initiative, which has been very much criticized both within the EU but also by the United States. So there are similar concerns, but I think that in the United States hasn't been seen in its in sort of like full-fledged sort of like problem like the EU sees. There is the same issue of the manipulation of the exchange rate. There is the same issue of the intellectual property right. It's not that they only do it with the United States. They do it with the European Union as well.
Hmm. So. All right, Professor. I think I do have one more question, if that's all right. Is that okay?
Sure.
Okay. Please correct me if I'm wrong again. Like, really feel free. To my understanding is that the U.S.'s justification for the tariffs, or like the way that they're going about doing it, is on national security grounds, and that there's like this provision in the WTO that says there's like some clause where if it's national security grounds, you're allowed to have a tariff, which normally you're not. Is that like, do you think that's a bogus claim? Do you think that's like totally, I'm trying to think the right word. Is that misusing the WTO system, or do you think they're like in any way justified by using the framework of the WTO to implement the tariffs.
And sort of maybe if I will, adding on to that, by going through the WTO in this specific manner, does that invoke the sort of multilateralism that you're promoting, or is it, as Zach sort of suggested,
fake
a distortion?
Multilateralism. Mm.
Well, first of all, the provision you're mentioning, it is part of the WTO, but it's specific. It's the 232 section of the U.S. trade law. So that allows for the United States to identify particular goods and services that are deemed of national security relevance. And so the country can decide how to go about it, even if an action on those items could be a violation of a WTO provision, which is why you can do it without being liable vis-a-vis the WTO.
Right.
Yes, there is the possibility of doing that. And one could see that particular aspects of what the United States is pushing for are definitely part of national security issues. Intellectual property right? Definitely. Forcing technology transfer? Absolutely. Cyber theft of all sorts of things? No problem with that. Mm-hmm. The issue with, once again, going down this road is where do we go next? Right. Let's not forget that the United States has invoked exactly the same section of the U.S. trade law to put sanction on the European Union and Canada on sort of like steel and part of sort of like and car parts. So that will be more on the side of what you were saying in terms of it's not a completely legitimate claim,
right,
but is used for a very specific point. One could see that based on what I was saying before, this is not forever, so things can change. The problem with many of these sanctions and the fact of invoking the 232 section is that it doesn't necessarily go away quickly. It was done, I think, in the 60s or the 70s, once again with Canada, and in that case was automotive parts. Mm. And in retaliation of some taxes that the Canada put on the some tariffs that Canada put on the U.S., and some of those tariffs are still in place these days. So many of these issues don't go away quickly because there is very often a long negotiation that follows, but also because there is an interest. So the provision is correct in its existence, and countries should have that. France uses all the time within the European Union when foreign companies or foreign countries wanted to buy more than a specific percentage of an important company for France. There is always a matter of national security. Whether or not that is an actual reflection of the issue is debatable. Mm-hmm. So in the case of China, we have definitely many yeses, but there are also some question marks.
Okay, cool. Thank you, Professor.
Thank you so much. I think we've all been really fortunate to have you here and explain to us the finer nuances of this issue, which I think are often left out in some other discussions. Yeah. And I think all of us learned a lot. Thank you.
I definitely learned.
Oh, yes.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming. And also, we hope that we can have you again soon. And all right, Zach, do you want to wrap it up?
Yes, as always, I have to remind everyone to please follow us on social media, the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. You can find us on Twitter at Hopkins POFA. You can find us on Instagram. We should maybe take a picture today so we can post it.
Photo shoot upcoming.
Yeah, take a listen and leave us a comment and send us some feedback. Thank you so much for listening and have a lovely day.